The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to the Pritzker Military Library Presents with our special guest, Sean Parnell. This program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Library in downtown Chicago and is made possible by the members of the Pritzker Military Library. Later on, we'll be taking questions from our studio audience and from those of you joining us on the internet at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. Sean Parnell is a former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger who served in the legendary 10th Mountain Division for 6 years, retiring as a captain. He received 2 Bronze Stars, including one for valor, and the Purple Heart. He joins us tonight to discuss his new book, Outlaw Platoon. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Library, Sean Parnell.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the honor to come here and speak to you today. I've been watching speeches at the Pritzker Military Library for about 5 years now, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here with you all tonight. There's a lot that happens in 485 days in combat, so I'm going to talk to you about a couple of key engagements today and some important aspects of the book that I think we all need to be aware of. And so first, I want to talk a little bit about why I joined the Army. I was a typical listless college kid as a sophomore. I was a sophomore in college, and I woke up one morning surrounded by beer cans on my couch in my college dorm room. And I turned on the TV, and I saw the World Trade Center's aflame. And I watched the towers collapse a few moments later. And I knew that at that moment in my life, I was at a fork in the road. I could either walk down the path and continue down the path as a listless college student with no sense of purpose or duty in my life, or I could choose to do something about it. And in that moment, I chose to do something about it, and I chose to act. And it changed my life forever. I graduated from college. I went to Air Defense Artillery Officer Basic Course, then went to Airborne School, went to Ranger School, and then moved to Fort Drum, New York as part of the legendary 10th Mountain Division. I went to Ranger School 215 pounds and in amazing shape and came out 165 pounds. It was one of the toughest experiences of my life. I arrived at Fort Drum, New York on Memorial Day and went to the Joint Readiness Training Center a few days after before I even had a place to live because I wanted to be there with my men training for combat. And a year after that moment, I realized a year after me being at the Joint Readiness Training Center, I was in Afghanistan. My grandfather, who had been a pillar of support in my life, growing up, he was a second father to me, passed away the day before I was supposed to deploy to Afghanistan. And my battalion commander, I talked to him and I said, you know, can I please go home to see the funeral? And he said, yes, Sean, go. So I drove all night to go to his funeral. I went to the wake and I talked to my grandmother and she says, Sean, he let himself go because he could watch over you better that way. He could protect you in combat and be there with you every moment. And she gave me a hug and a kiss, and I turned around and drove back up to Fort Drum that same night so that I could make sure that I was on the bird to Afghanistan before my men. I wrote the book because I wanted American society to know the sacrifice and courage that my men displayed in the face of great adversity. We were deployed for 485 days on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan in one of the most dangerous places on the face of the planet. And, you know, just to put that into perspective, the 101st Airborne jumped into Normandy and fought to Hitler's Eagle's Nest in less time than 485 days. And we stood in that last formation together after we had come back from Afghanistan and on this concrete pad. And I was looking at my men, and they were battered, wounded, broken, and studded with shrapnel. And they said, sir, I don't know how to tell my family what we went through, or I don't know how to tell my friends what the experience of combat was like. And in that moment, I made them a promise to tell them, to tell the world of their story. And 6 years later, here we are. And so let me tell you a little bit about my men. If they had one similarity at all, it was that they were entirely and completely different. I had my platoon sergeant, who is a 40-year-old guy. His name is Greg Greason. He's a chain-smoking, near-beer-drinking old man whose hallmark was a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and his rifle in his one hand. His voice was like a hybrid between Sam Elliott and Sling Blade, and he did not hesitate to yell at me or grunt at me anytime that I made a mistake, which is the mark of an amazing platoon sergeant. He trained me and taught me everything that I knew about being a leader. And I think one of the main things that a young lieutenant can do is be self-effacing and humble and just listen to his non-commissioned officers and let them train you. I had two squad leaders, Sergeant Jason Sabaki, or Sabo, and Sergeant Phil Baldwin. These two men were the yin and the yang of my platoon. They were complete opposites, yet they were best friends. Sergeant Sabaki was an atheist. Sergeant Phil Baldwin was a devout Christian. Sergeant Sabaki's body was tattooed and was like a Wikipedia entry on pagan symbolism. And Sergeant Phil Baldwin went to church and barbecued with his wife and family every single weekend. So Sergeant Sabaki blew through life with a raging inner passion, and Sergeant Baldwin had a measured and analytical mind. Yet none of that mattered, because they were comrades in arms with one another. I had Robert Pinholt, who is my radio man, a Dallas-born guy that wasn't a fan of the Cowboys but loved the Don Shula-era Dolphins. Go figure. This guy was a case study in contrasts. He loved reading John Steinbeck. He had the heart of a warrior and the mind of an economist. But he was a button-down conservative that didn't drink coffee, didn't drink beer, didn't smoke cigarettes, yet he listened to hippie rock like Fish and the Grateful Dead. Unbelievable, right? And then I had two cowboys in my platoon, Colt Wallace and Ryan Wheat. Colt was a beer-drinking, cigarette-smoking, womanizing, horse-punching cowboy brawler. Sergeant Wheat was a cucumber-cool, homesteading cowboy who was religious and lovingly devoted to his family. One of my other squad leaders was Sergeant Chris Cowan, who was an incredibly dry, sarcastic sense of humor. You could never tell if he was joking or telling the truth. His nickname was the Constrictor, because he was an overly aggressive guy that every time you walked by him, he'd wrap you in a vicious headlock and give you like a noogie, say, "How you doing, sir?" I had Sergeant Campbell, who was my quiet, tough-as-nails, natural athlete that was generally suspicious of authority figures, and that authority figure was me. I had Emmerich, who was my crazy platoon artist. I had Marcel Rowley, who was my Southern California emo lock-rubbing, Baja-driving skate punk, who was incidentally also a smart aleck prankster. On training events, I'd come back from the shower, and I came back to my bunk. Everything on my bunk, everything in my rucksack, completely laminated to include my shower shoes. And I looked over in the corner, and I saw Marcel Rowley snickering to himself, and I knew that it was him that had laminated everything that I owned. I had Chris Brown, who was a young kid from Memphis. He had a deep voice that was very characteristic of him. He was our platoon comedian, and this guy could thriller dance better than Michael Jackson, and he would do it perilously balancing on the back of a Humvee prior to combat patrols. And yet that was the contrast, right? This was a young kid in another life. He would have been a college student, but here he was on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, dancing on the back of a Humvee as his pre-mission ritual, right? Unbelievable. Something that I think I was really surprised as a leader was that five of my men weren't even citizens of this country when they joined. They came to this country because they loved it, and they believed in American exceptionalism with every fiber of their being. I had Nosov, who was from Russia. I had Doc Pantoja, my medic, who is a Mexican national. E. Chavez was from the Philippines. St. Jean, or the Haitian Hammer, was from Haiti. And Kantan Nguyen was from South Vietnam. These guys weren't even citizens of this country. So couple that with the fact that I had just been, think about how diverse and unbelievably diverse this group of men were, and the fact that I was a 24-year-old college student playing video games a year before, it's an unbelievably stark contrast. And now, here I was, like I said, playing video games a year before, and now I'm in charge of these 40 unbelievably unique men, their families, and their lives. Yet that is a situation that young leaders are put in our military every single day. So I felt it was important to tell you a little bit about my men because they're the reason why I wrote the book. So let me tell you about my first day in Afghanistan. My first day there, we had taken a CH-47 Chinook helicopter out to the border. We were stationed at a place called FOB Bermel. And as we landed, the FOB had been getting reports of sporadic rocket fire all day. FOB Bermel was the buffer. I mean, we were the last line of defense from enemies coming from Pakistan into Afghanistan, so we took a lot of flak. And there had been reports of intermittent rocket fire all day, and as our CH-47 landed, we had to rush off of the bird and onto the FOB as fast as humanly possible. We downloaded all of our equipment and immediately went back out to the range to zero our rifles. And the reason for that is, we zeroed them before we left, but the reason for that is that where we were operating at 10,000 feet. And the fact that we were operating at that high level, it can change the way that a bullet flies through the air because the air is thinner. So the first thing that we did was zero our rifles. And as we were zeroing our rifles, I heard this loud explosion and a shriek fly over my head, and I'm thinking, as a brand new lieutenant who has no experience whatsoever, oh my gosh, what was that? Are we being attacked? I had my platoon sergeant, Greg Greason, yell at me and grab me and said, get back on the FOB, we're under attack. It was like a glass of ice water to the face. I had no idea what was going on, but my platoon sergeant squared me away. So we all ran back to the FOB, and very quickly I realized how 10,000 feet, operating at 10,000 feet, affects a human being. My lungs were on fire, and I had barely run 100 yards. When we got back to the FOB, it was absolute pandemonium. There was smoke everywhere. All of my NCOs seemed to know exactly what to do, and they went right to the aid station, ready to act in the event that they were wounded. I stood there having no idea what to do. So I followed this trail of soldiers running towards the front gate, not knowing what happened. The commander of Forward Operating Base Bermel at the time was a member of the 173rd Airborne. His name is Ryan Kennedy, and he's a great friend of mine. He said, hey, Sean, some kids got hit with those rounds, and we need to get to the gate now. And I was shocked, and I ran to the front gate. And when I got there, I saw Abdul, who was our interpreter, arguing with a bunch of Afghan fathers about the boys needed to be treated first. They're in the hands of these adults were a bunch of young children, ages 2 to 8, that were broken, bleeding, and dying, or some that were already dead. And unfolding in this scene before me was an argument, hey, the boys need to be treated first. And as somebody from the United States, from an insulated Western culture, I didn't know what to make of that, but really, in that moment, I saw how truly different our two cultures were. And so eventually this argument came to a boiling point, and one of the non-commissioned officers from the Airborne Brigade acted and scooped up a random little child. And I followed suit and grabbed one, and before I had made it 3 steps, I had realized that I was holding a little girl in my arms, probably not more than 6 years old. And as I moved, I was moving as fast as I could to get her back to the aid station, and I started feeling wet here on the side of on my side. And I was wondering, you know, my mind was going 1,000 miles a minute, and I was wondering what it was. And I looked down, and as I looked down, I'm trying to comfort this girl and wipe her hair out of her face, and I looked down, and I see that what was saturating my uniform was her blood. And her leg was missing beneath the knee. And I started telling her, you know, it's okay, it's okay. Everything's going to be okay. And I didn't know whether I was talking to her or myself at that point. With every step that I took, her screams got less and less until she died in my arms on my first day in combat. And I slept walk her back to her parents and handed her to her father. And he looked at me in my eyes and I looked back at him. And we shared we shared that moment together, and he just nodded at me, and I handed him his daughter, and he turned around and walked away. And as I walked back to my room, reeling from this moment, and I didn't know how to process it, I saw Ryan Kennedy, who had already been, who was an airborne officer, had been in Afghanistan for a year already. He came up and slapped me on the shoulder. He said, "How you doing, Sean?" And I said, "Well, I don't know how I'm doing." He said, "Hey, listen." He said, "I know how you're feeling." He said, "But this is Afghanistan. Their goats mean more to them than their children. They can always have more children." And in that moment, I realized how different we truly were. And later that night in my room, I stared at my bloodstained uniform, and I thought to myself, there's no way that I can salvage this uniform. No amount of washing or cleaning is going to get the blood out. So I walked this uniform out to our burn pit, which was outside of our FOB, and I threw it in, and I watched it burn my first night there. And really, years later, I looked back on that moment, and I said to myself, well, geez, that's a pretty powerful metaphor for the beginning of the metamorphosis of a combat veteran. I had taken my insulated life that I had once known, that stateside skin that we all have before we go to combat, and I threw it in a burn pit, and it was gone forever. You call it insulated existence, you can call it innocence. Either way, that stateside existence that I had known was gone from me forever. And I took all the fear, and I took that horrifying moment, and I locked it away inside of me. And I did that because my men were arriving the next day, and they needed me to be strong for them. They needed me to project strength for them. They couldn't afford to see a leader that was weak, so I locked it away and I threw away the key. So that was my first day. You know, I talked a lot about my men just to give you a sense of how diverse they were, and but I don't think here in the United States that we talk enough about the role of an interpreter. I was responsible for my men and their families and their lives, as I mentioned before, but I also had an interpreter named Abdul who was integral in that talk at the front gate about getting the kids treatment as fast as humanly possible. Abdul was a kind and gentle-hearted man. He and I were more similar than I had initially thought, and here's how, and here's why. Abdul's father had been murdered by Arab foreign fighters in Afghanistan just as the invasion started. And Abdul became the primary breadwinner in his family. And he took up arms against his enemy by helping the United States. He joined and became an interpreter so that he could avenge his father's death. And all of this happened, and the foreign fighters were in Afghanistan, and all of this happened because of 9/11. Well, our lives were, our cause was the same. So, two men, two totally different cultures, but the same mission. And Abdul and I had tons of conversations like this, and so many, he was so integral to everything that we did in Afghanistan. He spoke five different dialects. He spoke Farsi, Dari, Pashto, Waziri, spoke Arabic. He knew the culture. He knew what the norms were. And without him, I would have been dead in the water. About 4 months into the deployment, our enemy found out where his family lived and started threatening his family. And for whatever reason, we didn't allow him to go and square that away. So he snuck out in the middle of the night to find and defend his family. And we never saw him again. The enemy, he had gotten down to his house. He had talked to his mother and his younger brother. He had come back, and these foreign fighters of the Taliban had ambushed him and assassinated him, and we ended up finding him the next day. And this was the first time I had ever had anybody die in combat that I knew and was close to. So, I mean, it was qualitatively different than the death of the little girl, and that affected me, but I didn't know her. And this time I knew Abdul, and I was close to him. And so nothing can prepare you for the first time that you see a body of somebody that you know. And in that moment, part of me was changed forever. And what was so sad about the whole thing is that a day later, I went to go see Abdul's body in this little wooden, what we called bee hut. And as I walked in the room, I saw this little wooden coffin, and I opened it, and he was wrapped in this white sheet. And it was a pauper's burial vessel. And Afghan interpreters, or just interpreters in general, they live in a constant state of limbo because they volunteer to serve people of the United States, or they volunteer to serve us. They can never truly be trusted by those in their village or their tribe again, and on the flip side, they can never be truly trusted by us because they're local Afghans. So they live and they're prisoners of this cultural divide, and they're a man without a country, essentially. And I looked at his coffin, and Abdul had been awarded, the airborne guys before us had given Abdul the combat infantryman's badge because of his valorous actions in combat, because he was such a trusted ally. And throughout the course of our first 4 months in Afghanistan, he was like, "Hey, sir, so have I done enough to get your ranger tab? Have I done enough to earn that to go along with my combat infantryman badge?" I'm like, "Hey, Abdul, you're going to need to do a lot more than that to earn a ranger tab, okay? It's a lot harder. You know, you can't just talk to somebody and get a ranger tab." And he said, "Well, I'll do something to earn it someday." And in that coffin, while he lay there, I gave him my ranger tab because I think that he earned it. And when I left that room with Abdul's body, I was filled with a bunch of conflicting emotions. I was scared. I was afraid at what might happen to us. I knew that combat was on the horizon. This was the enemy's. This was an example of our enemy's long dark reach, which is the name of a chapter in the book. And this was the first time that they struck out at us. And I knew that combat was looming on the horizon, and I knew that eventually I would have to face decisions under fire to prove myself to my men. And I knew that I would have to do it without Abdul, who was my closest confidant and linked to the Afghan people. So the spring offensive officially started for us in May. And my first chance to prove myself under fire to my men came in May 7th, 2006. We were tasked with doing our very first patrol with our Afghan National Army counterparts. They were supposed to take us out on this mission, show us around the area of operations, take us back in this lawless border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, because this is the first time we could actually get back there, because the weather in Afghanistan in the winter prohibits movement back there. So as we drove back behind the ridgeline, we were instantaneously ambushed. We had gotten reports all throughout the first week in May that the enemy was planning a big assault, and we were all kind of wondering when that was going to be. It came on May 7th, 2006 when they ambushed us. And they started their ambush with a volley fire of rocket-propelled grenades aimed at my convoy. And what had happened was, as soon as they ambushed us, all of the Afghan National Army trucks that were in front of us, every member of the Afghan National Army dismounted and ran. So every truck that the Afghan National Army, every truck that they were using served as a roadblock. We couldn't drive through the ambush. We couldn't back up because we had trucks behind us too. To our left was a sheer cliff that ran 2,500 meters straight up. To our right, right as you would get outside of our door, was a sheer drop and then a gully to where the enemy was shooting at us from a ridgeline about 200 meters away. So they had picked a spot to ambush us where they knew that the Afghan National Army, they could use the Afghan National Army as a roadblock because the enemy knew that they would dismount and run. They knew that if they ambushed us in that position with this cliff to our left, it would interrupt our radio communications with the FOB, thereby limiting our artillery and fixed-wing aircraft that we could bring to bear on them. And they chose to ambush us in a spot where we couldn't get out and dismount and assault through the ambush, which is what our field manuals say for us to do in situations like this. So we were pinned down, outmanned, outgunned, surrounded, and trapped in my first engagement. And I had been bullied a lot as a kid growing up. I'd been tortured pretty badly on the bus and watched as my best friends, or quote-unquote friends, stood around and did nothing to defend me. And as I sat alone and processed these instances of me being bullied in my room at night, I knew and promised myself that if I ever had or was in a position of power to protect the people around me or protect people that I was in charge of or serving, I would act. And there was an instance in Watertown where one of my squad leaders, Staff Sergeant Phil Baldwin, said, "You know, sir, we have a great working relationship together, but we've got to get these men out of work so that we can establish a social relationship together. Because when the bullet starts flying, it's really important for all of us to know each other on a personal level." So he recommended that I get everybody out away from work, maybe have a few beers and grab a bite to eat before the deployment. So we did that, and we went to a bar. And well, I guess I had watched this woman reject one of my men on the dance floor while they were drinking, and I made a snarky comment to this woman. I guess I had probably had a little bit too much to drink, and I probably shouldn't have said anything, but I did it nonetheless. And I found myself in the bathroom about a month before we were supposed to deploy. I get jumped by this woman's four men that her entourage, and I, you know, as they grabbed me by the back of my collar and were dragging me out the door, I said, "Guys, listen, this is like the worst. I'm just looking out for you. Please don't beat me up, okay? I'm looking out for you. I don't want anything bad to happen to you. Please just let me go." And they didn't want to hear anything of it, so they continued to drag me outside. And I looked at my men who were standing all around the bar, and we were all drinking and establishing this social relationship together. And I just gave him one of these to rally. And literally within moments of me giving them that signal, they swarmed outside and grabbed these four or five guys off of me and broke up this fight. And so if you think about in that moment, they defended me when I needed them most. And I swore that I would always, because of me being bullied as a kid, I swore that I would always use, if I was ever in a position of power, I would always stand up for the people that I cared about. And in that moment, they showed me that they cared about me too. And that, on May 7th, when we were surrounded, outmanned, outgunned, and trapped, that's what propelled me to get out of the truck in the middle of the kill zone and try to figure out a way to get us out of there. I didn't think about dying. I didn't think about anything else but how much I loved and cared about my men, and I didn't want anything to happen to them. So I got out of the truck and stepped into the storm, and I found myself running up this hill to try to rein in the ANA, get them back into their trucks. And as I passed Phil Baldwin's truck, whose truck had just been hit by a rocket-propelled grenade and smoke was rising from the underside of it, I slammed on his window. I didn't say anything because I was under fire, and I was feeling rounds go through my clothes. I had rounds going through my magazine holder, through my pant legs, and I just kept saying to myself, "You've got to keep moving or you're going to die." So I slammed on his windshield as I ran by, and I just kept running. And I said, "Oh my God, is anybody going to follow me? I never gave anybody an order. Had I just made a huge mistake?" And you never know these things in combat. And as I just kept running, and as I turned over my shoulder, I saw Phil Baldwin charging up the hill after me. And behind him, the rest of my platoon, Outlaw Platoon, were charging up the hill to take the high ground. And I look back on that moment, and I think that was my moment to prove myself under fire to my men. And I think some people, you only have a few seconds to do that. You know, in garrison, a good leader does what he can for his men to protect them from garrison politics. But in combat, you do it under fire. And I think that was my moment. So we took the high ground, and we ended up winning that engagement. Even though we were outnumbered, greatly outnumbered and surrounded, we ended up winning that engagement. And we returned to the FOB with our first victory in combat, which the first time an infantry platoon comes back from combat and wins, it's a feeling, it's an unbelievable feeling. And I had went back to the FOB, and I had talked to my company commander because he wanted to hear everything that had happened, and I ended up finally making my way to the DFAC, to the dining facility, to grab a bite to eat because it was really late. And I walk in there, and the men of my platoon are sitting there all at these tables. And I walk in, and of course, it instantly gets quiet. And I'm thinking, oh no, here we go. My non-commissioned officers, my NCOs or squad leaders are gonna berate me in front of the men because I made a mistake out there. What's gonna happen? And I walk into this, and I walk into the chow hall, and Sergeant Phil Baldwin stands up, and he walks over to me, and I'm thinking, oh, here it comes. And he slaps me on the shoulder, and he said, sir, you did an amazing job out there. Great job. And my entire platoon erupted and was cheering. We were all hugging and high-fiving. And for a young lieutenant who has absolutely no experience, there is no better feeling in the world than to be accepted into that brotherhood and family that is your platoon. So I went back to my room on cloud nine, knowing that I had done right by my men that day, and I laid in bed and I thought about that engagement. And I was thinking about this is my first engagement, and this is the first time that we had fought the enemy. And I was thinking about, like, the violence that combat is. And I thought to myself, you know, I was cheering as men were being blown to pieces by a 50 caliber on the battlefield. And I was thinking, like, oh my gosh, how does Sean, the human being, coexist with Sean, the combat leader? Or Sean the warrior, or can they? And to this day, I haven't been able to reconcile that question, but I know that I couldn't sleep that night because of it, and I ended up walking outside. And in that moment, I had never felt further from home in that moment than I did in that moment, and trying to process the violence, the violent nature of combat. The following day, my squad leaders had a meeting, and we made a pact with one another because we had seen other units come back from the spring offensive that had broken contact, and the men came back themselves broken and worried and scared. And so even though the decision, these other units' decisions to break contact were certainly right, given the tactical situation on the ground, the men came back themselves broken. And so the enemy had achieved a moral victory over them. So my squad leaders and I promised right there in that moment that we would never break contact with the enemy. We would never give them a moral victory. So right there, we made a pact to stand and fight toe-to-toe. And a month later, on June 10th, 2006, we got a chance to make good on that pact. On June 9th, 2006, we went out to establish a traffic control point. And we were right on the main info route between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And our job was to try to interrupt and check every vehicle coming from Pakistan, because that was where our enemy was coming from. And we heard nothing. There was not a sound out there. No traffic, no livestock. All the lights in all the houses around us were out. And we got a feeling that something was up. So my squad leaders had said, hey, sir, we've got to get up on some high ground for the night and tuck in. We don't like this feeling. So we looked around and we picked this big mountain in the middle of the night, walked up, took it, and set up our security up at the top of this hill, and we tucked in there for the night. As soon as the sun crested up over the hill, we started listening in on the enemy on their radio chatter, because the enemy talks in these walkie-talkie things, and we've got them too, so you can just listen. And they were talking about moving all of their men to this cave complex that the Americans had bombed, that we had bombed a month prior. And I knew where that was. I was like, oh my gosh, that's the cave complex. It's right over there. Let's call for fire on it and let's see what happens. So I called this fire mission on it. And I walked over there and I watched these rounds impact all around the cave. And I thought to myself, okay, your play, let's see what you got. And no sooner did I walk back to my truck that the entire world around me went dark. I woke up and I opened my eyes, and I came to trees exploding all around me. They had been using airburst mortars, and trees were snapping like matchsticks all around me. I was looked to my left, and I saw my platoon sergeant, Greg Greason, guy that's tough as nails, taught, coached, and mentored me every single day, screaming at me behind this big tree that had exploded above him, and he was being showered with pine needles and splinters and everything else, pointing to his shoulders. He had been hit. So I rolled over and I was watching this unfold, and as I rolled over, I was literally looking at rounds impacting right next to my arm. And I turned my head to the southeastern portion of our perimeter, and I was watching Mike Emmerich, our platoon artist, and Sergeant Campbell, our squad leader, both on 50 caliber, screaming at the top of their lungs and firing these weapon systems. And as I was watching this unfold, I watched Emmerich's head snap back and him fall into the turret. And I had just watched him get shot in the head. And then I moved my attention to the far eastern portion of our perimeter, and I saw Phil Baldwin and Bennett Garvin were grievously wounded, Phil with a bullet wound to the leg and Bennett Garvin with a bullet wound to the arm. And for a young platoon leader at the time, I saw this and I was shocked. Men were scrambling for cover. Baldwin and Garvin were bleeding out. And I knew that I had to get up from this injury. I had burning pieces of shrapnel all over my leg. And I knew that I had to get back to my truck to call the FOB because I knew that we could not withstand this for much longer. So I ran back to my truck and I called the FOB and I said, hey, we're not going to make it. We need to get a QRF, a quick reaction force, out here as soon as humanly possible. My company commander, who had luckily been patrolling a couple of kilometers to the north, responded and said, we see what's happening and we're coming to you. Hang on, brother. So I turned my attention to my forward observer, who was white-knuckled in the truck, and I said, Reuter, how you doing, buddy? And he said, sir, we got to get out of here. I'm like, Reuter, we can't go. Two of our trucks are completely destroyed. We've got to stay. And he said, sir, I know, but we got to get out of here. I said, Reuter, we can't get out of here, but what you can do right now is to call fire on those two ridge lines where all of the mortars were coming from. And I looked at him and he looked at me and I saw a shift in his perspective, and he got it and immediately started getting to work. And then I looked to in the back seat of my truck, and I saw Robert Pilon, who is my squad. My SAW gunner, a squad automatic weapon. And he was looking at me. I said, hey, Pilon, I need you over on that eastern front, on that eastern portion of our perimeter. And he just looked at me and nodded, and he went. And I thought, in that moment, I thought, these guys are just guys out of high school. These aren't special operators. These aren't Navy SEALs. These are just straight-legged infantrymen that are doing amazing things. And he bounded across this perimeter to the eastern portion of our perimeter. And so I thought to myself, okay, what do I do now as a young lieutenant? What is my role? And for, I think, a young lieutenant, it's always to be right in the center of the fight in the most dangerous place. So I ran to the east and followed Pilon on the eastern portion of our perimeter. And I was watching the ridgeline, and I was watching these airburst mortars come over, and I saw that there were two separate support by fire positions with three machine guns apiece on each ridgeline. And what they had done was they had used the airburst mortars to keep our heads down while simultaneously emplacing two support by fire positions. And what they had us in this crossfire that was an X. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, this is exactly what we do. We use artillery to keep the enemy's head down, and then we emplace support by fire position so they can't shoot back. And that's exactly precisely what the enemy had done. And I started thinking to myself, okay, so if that is what they're doing, if they're fighting like we do, what would I do if I were in that position? And it clicked in my head, and I said, two assault elements. They're going to hit us with two assault elements. So I started screaming up and down the line, be prepared for a two-pronged assault, be prepared for a two-pronged assault. And no sooner did I say that I see the enemy start pouring over the hills in two 40 to 50 man elements. They had 150 some people. I had 25 on the ground. We were outnumbered 4-1. And I saw the enemy come pouring over the hills. What struck me was how sophisticated the enemy was. Not only were they running, they weren't running fanatically, they were bounding in squad-size elements. Well, one element shot and fired, and the other element moved, and I was shocked by that. I ran back to my truck to link up with my platoon sergeant to ask him what to do, and I said, hey, Sergeant Greason, what do we do? And he looked at me and said, I don't know, sir, shoot back. And I said, great. If a platoon leader is shooting back, it's a bad day for everybody, because my radio in combat, I think, is my best weapon. So I ran back out to the perimeter on the eastern front, and I was just about to shoot, and I trained my weapon in on an enemy squad leader, and he was ducked behind a tree, and I aimed, and I shot, and I and it hit him right here in the chest, and he fell. And for a split second, my consciousness was like, Sean, you just killed somebody. Sean, you just killed somebody. And a split second later, I locked it away and said, you can think about it later. That was the first and last time that I ever fired my weapon on the deployment. And I said, you know what? I can do a lot better than this. We're not going to go down like this. I'm not going to go down shooting. And I passed my magazines to my trigger pullers, and I went back to my radio. And Sergeant Greason had told me, sir, we've got to get Baldwin and Garvin out of here. They're bleeding out. They're out there trapped on the eastern perimeter. And so we tried to orchestrate a rescue for these guys, and it ended up being Howard and myself, because Sergeant Greason was pinned down on the other side of the perimeter. He couldn't make it to them. So sometimes being a leader in combat means retaining elements of the humanity that you had before going in. It's not just about the mission, it's about taking care of your men as well. So it was on me, my medic, and my 240 gunner to get him. So we orchestrated a rescue attempt, and I said, we're going to go get him on three. One, two, three, and we all started running. And as we were running, a mortar landed right probably 20 meters from me and knocked me unconscious again. This time when I came to, I opened my eyes and to this small butterfly on this rock right in front of me. I was laying on my side and I saw this butterfly, and in the backdrop was Doc Pantoja treating Garvin and Phil Baldwin bleeding. I'm thinking, gosh, a butterfly in the middle of all this. This is kind of unbelievable. And as I tried to pick my head up, I felt this clear liquid leaching out of my nose and of my ears. And I thought, oh God, this is bad. But I forced myself up anyway, and I went to help Doc Pantoja evacuate Garvin. And as I was running over to him, a mortar round hit right next to Doc Pantoja, and he jumped on Garvin's body to protect him. And as he picked his head back up, I saw Doc Pantoja get shot in the face. And I was screaming for Doc. I was screaming for him. And as I got to him, Doc Pantoja miraculously pops back up, and the side of his face is completely ruined. And he runs over to me. He's like, sir, sir, what happened to your head? Are you okay? And I'm like, what happened to my head, Doc? You just got shot in the face. And he's like, don't worry about me. Don't worry about me. Let's get Garvin out of here. So Doc Pantoja is ordering me around on the top of this hill. So we get Garvin out of there. And as I turn around, we get Garvin safe. Doc goes to work on him. And I look back and I see Phil Baldwin, who is now trying to crawl back with this leg wound himself. And as I see him crawling back, I see him. He's reaching one hand at a time and one hand at a time. And I see a round literally hit right in front of his hand. And he looked at me in that moment, and he, for some reason, that round seemed to affect him pretty deeply. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he turned around on his back and just laid down, because he knew that there was no way for him to make it back. And I said to myself, there's no way that I'm going to let that happen. And I ran out to get him. And I started dragging him, and I realized that he's 6'4", 225 pounds, and he was heavy. So I grabbed him by this handle on the back of his body armor, and I was pulling him, and I couldn't move him. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, at least if I'm going to die, I'm going to die with Phil Baldwin next to me. So I'm pulling him and I'm not moving him and I'm about to quit. And who shows up at my side but Doc Pantoja with a bullet wound to his face. And I'm like, God, this guy is a machine. He grabs Phil Baldwin and he says, let's go, sir. Come on, get the lead out. You can do better than this. And he starts dragging Phil Baldwin back with a bullet wound to the face. And I thought, oh my gosh, does America know the mettle of her warrior sons? So I made my way back to the eastern perimeter, and I saw the enemy was about 20 meters away from us. And I was just about to give the command, fix bayonets, because I knew that it was going to be hand-to-hand. And I realized that we don't carry bayonets anymore. And I thought, well, darn it. And at that moment, just as we were about to be overrun, I heard this secondary engagement, and Captain Dye and Delta Platoon, the trucks that he were with, came tearing out of nowhere, and he parked himself right between the enemy and us. In that 20 meters, he parked himself right between, just as we were out of ammunition. We immediately emplaced his trucks amongst our perimeter and cross-loaded all of our ammunition. And I said, oh, finally, we're good. We're safe. And then I hear Afghan voices behind us. And I turn around and I see Afghans charging up over the hill from our rear. And they were dressed in these ratty battle dress uniforms with scarves and masks on. And I said, this is it. And I went to grab my knife. And right behind him were Marines, and it was ANA. So I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, you're safe 1 minute, you're about to be overrun, then you're safe, and then you're thinking you're overrun, and then you're safe again. And that's combat. Combat does that to you. Combat whipsaws your emotions like nothing else can. And eventually, we held off the enemy. The ANA went to task on the enemy. And as we were trying to evacuate Phil Baldwin, the enemy had taken advantage of me and Greason and Sergeant Sabaki moving Phil Baldwin because he's a big guy. And we were targeted as we were moving, and we got hit with a machine gun, and one of my sergeants got hit in the arm and immediately had his artery severed. And no sooner did his artery get severed, Doc Pantoja, bullet wound to the face and all, ran over, wrapped a tourniquet on it, treated him. Sergeant Dixon, the guy who was shot, ran over to the other side, grabbed Baldwin with his other good arm and ran him back down to the truck. And as I was holding Baldwin's hand in the last moments in the truck, he said, sir, sir. And I was holding his hands and I could see he had Afghan dirt and blood on his face. I said, what's up, Phil? How are you doing? He said, I can't feel my legs. And the trucks took him away. And that was the last I heard of him until the end of the deployment. So for 485 days, we endured things like this. And let me fast forward here just in the interest of time so I can get to some questions. At the end of the deployment, I watched this unbelievably diverse group of men get onto the bird and start to leave. And I started thinking to myself, like, what if we had a strength, if we had one great strength, what was it? And I realized in that moment that Outlaw Platoon, our greatest strength was our great diversity, just like the United States of America. And an army, I realized in that moment, mirrors the nation that it's sworn to protect. And the outlaws were a microcosm of America's greatest strength, which is what I mentioned was diversity. And what we did was we just, rather than being, you know, having a diverse group of men and having that be divisive, we harnessed that together through love and brotherhood. And we took that and ran with it and created an environment that empowered that group of men to do amazing things. And so, you know, as I watched my men fly out, I knew that one of the only reasons that we had stayed alive was because of the love and brotherhood that we had for one another. And our differences didn't matter. The only thing that mattered was one another. And I'd like to conclude my talk with that statement. Maybe answer any questions. I know, you know, and I went a little bit over, so I'd like to answer some questions that you guys might have. Who's going to go first?
Sean, my name's Pat O'Donnell. I served with the 173rd Airborne in Vietnam in 1967-68, so I'm very familiar with what you went through because I went through the same thing. My question, I'm also the host of Veterans Views radio program Coast to Coast, but I'd also like to ask you this question. I notice on the front of your book, you have guys with the rucksacks on.
Yes.
We carried like 90 to 100 pounds on the rucksacks, and at some time we had to get down and put them on and have them. Buddy, did you guys have to do the same thing?
Sometimes, yeah. We had 90 to 100 pounds walking at 10,000 feet. It was an unbelievably arduous task. And yeah, the way that you do it is you get down, which is, I'm sure you know, you get down and you have somebody cinch your rucksack on and you just have somebody help you stand up. Yeah, it was one heck of a task walking those mountains. And what's interesting is that we were totally opposite to the enemy that we're facing, because in Vietnam, I think it was the same thing, but we had an enemy that carried a pack of rice, a chest rack with ammunition, and their rifle. They were already acclimatized to the area, and we were 90 pounds of gear, weren't acclimatized yet. Somehow we managed to win every engagement. And I think that the way that we did that was just our American grit and not wanting to lose. But yeah, that's a great, that was a great question.
You described basically going into your first combat situation as a commander when you hadn't actually been in combat before. And I'm sure you talked with other junior officers about and observed other junior officers and other units in the similar situations. Do you think it would be an advantage to the Army if they would make basically say that before anybody gets put into a command position that's going to be in combat, they have to have seen combat first, so they won't at least have seen the elephant once first?
Boy, that's a great question. I mean, I think it would be a great idea, but for a guy like me, you know, I think two kinds of people come back from combat. You have people that come back from combat and they want that adrenaline rush again and they seek it out in other forms. And you have a guy like me who came back from combat who is petrified of literally everything. I don't even like riding a bike driving down the road. I don't even like riding a two-wheel bicycle anymore because I felt like my nine lives were up. So I'm thinking that, like, maybe if we did that, you might have a lot of guys say, well, the heck with this. I don't want to do this anymore. But I think it's a great idea. For sure. It's something that I think the military should think about. Oh, sure.
Sean, my name is Terrell Jensen, and I never served, and I thank all you guys who are and have. I just started the book, and one thing that I got out of the book a little bit more that you might want to share with us was the barroom fight. Seemed to sort of jumpstart your esprit de corps and also create the name of the platoon, I guess. Yeah. And it was, those guys did more than save you. They did a little more than that.
Yeah.
but I was really interested in that, how that got things going for you guys as a real team.
Oh my, that's a great comment, and I'm so glad that you picked up on that. You know, that moment did solidify us as a team. You know, we had working relationships together, but that can only really go so far. You know, I think as Phil Baldwin recommended to me, you've got to do something, sir, to have these guys build social bonds together. And incidentally, after that moment, my non-commissioned officers and I, you know, they recommended, hey, sir, we need to come up with a name so that these guys can coalesce around a collective group identity in combat, so they have something to fall back on. Because the only thing that matters in combat is the man next to you in the group. So let's give him a name, let's figure out what we can call him, and we settled on the Outlaws. And they took that name and they did amazing things with it. But you were right, that barroom dust-up was the catalyst that started it all. Sure.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering about the difference between you and me and somebody that hasn't been in combat, and the fact that you guys are fighting something that we have, are not doing anything about. And it makes me wonder about, and I like how to put this, the effect of someone who is deployed four or five times and the effect it has on these people, if you understand.
Yeah.
Get my drift.
I do, yeah. Well, there's absolutely no question that our military is strapped. You know, our men and women in the United States military today have endured year-on-year off deployments for 10 years now, and that puts a strain on families. It puts a strain on parents' relationships with children. And I think, quite honestly, our military right now is fried. They're tired and exhausted, and it has devastating effects, as like I said, on families, not only families, but on the human psyche as well. Men and women are just tired. They're just tired now. Did that answer your question?
I guess I'm thinking of the effects of PTSD and those things that happen. And it's just, I guess, the moral thing that we're not required to do anything.
Yeah.
The rest of us aren't doing anything. And the way things have been set up is that a few people do it all. And I guess I'm thinking about the recent...
The shootings. Yeah, here's...
Is this all thing fair?
Yeah, well, there's no question, I think, that our military is at war and America itself is not. But we'll talk more about this in a little bit.
Sean Parnell. Thanks to Sean Parnell for joining us. The book is Outlaw Platoon, published by William Morrow. The program is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Library. You can learn more about the library, download the audio podcast, or view our other archived programs by visiting our website at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. Please join us next time, and the Pritzker Military Library presents.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the library. Series sponsors: Albert and Audrey Ratner, Karen L. Pritzker and Michael K. Vallach, Robert and Myrie Pritzker. If you would like to be a member of our studio audience or learn more about the library, visit us at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org.
The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.